Hello, and welcome again to another Conservative Historian podcast. This one entitled, The Fog of War. The date, March 2023, and my name is Bell Avis. It is well that war is so terrible, otherwise we should grow too fond of it. Robert E. Lee. Any military commander who is honest with himself, or with those he is speaking to, will admit that he has made mistakes in the application of military power. He's killed people, unnecessarily, his own troops or other troops. Through mistakes, through errors of judgment, 100, 1,000, or 10,000, maybe even 100,000. But he hasn't destroyed nations. And the conventional wisdom is, don't make the same mistake twice. Learn from your mistakes, and we all do. Maybe we make the mistake three times, but hopefully not four or five. Robert McNamara. I think I've shared this before. The first history book I can remember reading, well over 30 years ago, was about the battle for Iwo Jima. For all of the horrific nature of that battle, it was, well, relatively as these things go, straightforward. For one, it was an island. Two, both the American Marines and the Japanese Imperial Army had fought for over 2 years. These were men who had the savagery down. When we read about wars and battles, they are written with the sense of hindsight. The historian knows things that the generals, the officers, the NCOs, and indeed the men doing the core fighting, could not possibly know at the time. Economists sometimes get a bad rap, and I'm certainly one who doesn't really mind a little piling on, but that is just because they take the theoretical and the historical, try to merge them, and then try to predict the future. As of this writing, the United States has seen two regional banks fail, both in the top 10 regarding assets. This occurred in the past 3 weeks. Yet the Biden administration, foolishly in my estimation, guaranteed all depositors' deposits, even beyond that of the FDIC-insured $250,000. The concern was that the failure of these banks would cause contagion beyond these smaller banks. We cannot know whether that would have happened. But in the interim, one of the factors in the bank failures was due to overinvestment in long-term treasuries in an era in which the Federal Reserve rate increases reduces the value of those long-term treasuries. In other words, the bank should have seen all of this coming. A lot of this isn't just some sort of systemic issue with banking, and certainly not with capitalism, but that the people in one case running the Silicon Valley Bank were probably not great bankers. Yet, despite these bank failures, the Fed continues these rate increases. Does Jerome Powell, Federal Reserve Chair, know categorically that this is the right course? Now, he believes it to be, but he cannot know for certain. But a historian does, because we will write the history of Powell at some point in the future. But one of the things a historian can capture is the sense that the figures of any given time in their present do not know the future and cannot know which decision is best categorically. Historians often are guilty of injecting their figures with foresight that only resulted because they guessed correctly. We talk of Lincoln's diligence in prosecuting the Civil War, but after, let's say, Chancellorsville, for example, he could not know that the North would inevitably prevail. The fact that he guessed right and had the resolution to see through to victory is as much about his character as it is about some magical prognostication ability on Lincoln's part. In January, I was introduced to Rick Atkinson's Army at Dawn. There are so many pleasures in life. Great food, great conversation, and, well, it's a family podcast, so I will admit some of the other great things about life. But among those, at least for me, is discovering a great historian. Now, my historical library contains some 800 volumes that I have. I have also perused hundreds more libraries across this nation and Europe. And I have read, well, frankly, some bad writers who provide a crap history. In the United States, there are nearly 250,000 new books published annually, and I myself accounted for one of those in 2020, and thousands of them are history, and a huge percentage of those, frankly, again, are garbage. So what makes a great historian? Well, really, there are three main pillars. First, they need to be great researchers. You can often tell which historians do their homework and who are phoning it in. For example, Atkinson was on a rate of a new book about every 5 years. 5 years. That's how long it took him to do his research. That is how long it took him to get the words on the page, or on the computer, as probably is the case. And you can also see it in their notes section at the end of the book. Atkinson's tend to run well over 100 pages. One of his books has nearly 200 pages of notes. This guy looked at everything. Second is the ability to write exciting prose. And this is not about being a Voltaire with flourishes or using super big words, but rather the ability to tell a story, because history is our story, the story of humanity. If we cannot read these works and maybe learn a little something about the inside of us, the writer has failed. And finally, it should be sort of a detective story, trying to make sense out of a jumble of facts. Again, 200 pages of notes, that means that Rick Atkinson has put a lot of facts into his books. And sure, a lot of historians put in a little speculation. They might put in a little of opinions about what they think all of these facts mean, but the good historians do not start with a preset point and then cherry-pick facts to fit that particular opinion. History should not be a venue to make a political or social point. Now, often I'm accused of doing just that, which I condemn, starting with a preset narrative and then again, cherry-pick facts to fit. Quite the opposite. To me, the facts create the narrative. And of the critical things that Atkinson did in his work is illustrate the narrative of how the Americans in 1942, in the deserts, mountains, and rivers of Tunisia, were immersed in the fog of war. Continually, from Eisenhower down to the lieutenants and sergeants, plans were made, and often, not always, but often, the plans needed to be corrected. Eisenhower's selection of certain generals, the mistrust between the Americans and the British, the understanding of the terrain, the combination of disparate, unfamiliar units, and above all, the wrong guesses about what the Germans would do, in Atkinson's telling, were elements of this fog of war. War is often equated to chess, but in that game, you may not know what your opponent intends, but at least you can see all of their pieces. In war, it is both ways. A better analogic game is Stratego, or even Battleship, where a player sometimes bumbles all over the game board, hoping for a strike, or in the case of the former, the game Stratego, not running a high-ranking player into an ambush. Rick Atkinson is among the great ones, ranging from Barbara Tuchman to Victor Davis Hanson, with some Joseph Ellis and Jared Diamond thrown in. I have consumed Stephen Ambrose, Paul Johnson, and David McCullough, and I am still working on An Army at Dawn with Atkinson. But here's the good news. Not only have I not finished Army at Dawn, I have two more to go in his trilogy on World War II, The Day of Battle and The Guns at Last Light. Sometimes I feel like a kid who does not have to wait for Christmas, and in my case, it's going to come in three. There are many ways to break down warfare. There is the wars fought by brilliant protagonists such as, I don't know, Hannibal, Genghis Khan, or Napoleon. The second is the general with a massive technological advantage, as seen in the first Gulf War. Now, Norman Schwarzkopf was a great general, but it was really, was it a contest when he had the tech he possessed against the Iraqis? And the third is the most common. Armies where advantages are unclear, and the waging of war is shrouded in confusion. When Robert McNamara uses that term, the fog of war, in 2003's Academy Award-winning documentary by Errol Morris, there is a, well, kind of a self-serving aspect. Like much of McNamara's career, he did not fail to win the Vietnam War because of the faulty strategy, bad tactics, or the inability to choose the right generals in his capacity as Secretary of Defense, but rather he blames it on an externality, the fog of war. That's what was defeated him. Now, if we could conjure golden ducats out of thin air every time intelligent, clever people blame things other than their own decisions for subsequent shortcomings, we could fix the national debt in about a week. Nevertheless, this is not just about McNamara. Nations and their leaders go into war with a preset strategy and expectations. They also go into it with about, 4,000 years of documented warfare experience. The father of history, well, at least Western history, Herodotus wrote of war. So did Thucydides. But all of the accumulated knowledge cannot provide answers or anticipations for all of the details of actual warfare. Even before the conflict begins, some armies are well-equipped and well-trained. When Alexander of Macedon crossed the Hellespont, his army had been honed over 20 years of near unrelenting campaigning against northern Macedonian tribes, Thessalonians, and the Greeks. When the Roman consul Gaius Marius faced down the Germans at Achaia Sextia, his legions had been prepared for years for the encounter. Then there are the logistics. Napoleon said an army moves on its stomach, and so he was very correct. Armies are composed mainly of men between the ages of 18 and 40. And remember, there's thousands of them, tens of thousands of them, or in the case of World War II, millions of them. Then you push these men, ages tend to be 18 to 40, and then you push them through vigorous exertions, all of which means they must constantly be equipped with food and water. In Alexander's case, the Persian desert did to his army what the Greeks, the Persians, the Bactrians, and the Indians could not. It decimated it. And this is just the physical aspect of keeping a 25-year-old male from hunger. Medical supplies and sound equipment are essential. And not just good stuff, but the right stuff, as Atkinson notes. Winter coats meant to see the British army through the Tunisian winter in 1942 went to the bottom of the Mediterranean, courtesy of a U-boat, causing acute affliction outside of Tunis when the cold arrived in the winter months. And of course, there were the horrific stories of Charles XII's Swedes, Napoleon's French, and Hitler's Germans when caught in a Russian winter without the proper equipment or shelter. And none of this accounts for the basics of weaponry, such as guns, bullets, cannons, cannonballs, and gunpowder, or in the case of the ancients, good swords and shields. An example of war fog surrounded Marcus Crassus at the Battle of Carrhae. The Romans had defeated foes ranging from Carthaginians, Macedonians, Greeks, Numidians, Germans, and Gauls, with an army focused on infantry. But the Parthians that Crassus faced in 53 BCE represented something else. In a piece by Ludwig Heinrich Dake, the author notes, "In keeping with their steppe heritage, the Parthians grew to manhood in the saddle. They were attuned to the heat and adept at conserving and finding water. Parthian armies brought with them droves of extra horses so they had access to fresh mounts. The mainstay of the Parthian army was light archers mounted on Arabian-like steeds." Now, Crassus made two great mistakes at Carrhae. The first was believing that the Parthian arrows, fired from lethally effective composite bows, would run out. But the Parthians had a camel train that continually renewed their supply. The second was something that the future Mongols, a false retreat, would perfect centuries in the future. Dake adds, "When the Parthians took to flight, Publius Crassus, Marcus Crassus's son, hardly pressed on in pursuit. The lighter Parthian horsemen appeared to have scattered. Nevertheless, Publius carried on after the cataphracts. The armored horses of the cataphracts were not only slower than those of the Gauls, who were under Publius's command, but Serena, the commander of the Parthian host, was among them. After the last legionnaires following Publius had disappeared from Marcus Crassus's sight, the chase had ended. The cataphract suddenly wheeled around at that point while Parthian light cavalry galloped in from different directions. The Parthian retreat had been a feint. Publius reined in his cavalry and waited for the infantry to catch up. Bows twanged, arrows swooshed as the Parthians concentrated their fire on Publius' legionnaires. No longer mentioned in the sources, the Roman archers were probably hopelessly outmatched. The horses raised a massive cloud of dust, obscuring the vision of both parties, and the Romans were so densely packed that the Parthian archers could scarcely miss. Publius Crassus and eventually his father Marcus both died at Carrhae, and another Roman, Cassius Longinus, retrieved enough troops to prevent the Parthians from conquering all of Syria. This is the same Cassius who famously teams up with Brutus to take down the tyrant, or at least that's what they called him, Julius Caesar, but I digress, that's a story for another time. And though it would be another 400 years before cavalry replaced infantry as the decisive weapon of war, this was one of the inceptions of it. Now, beginning around roughly 400 CE, cavalry was to enjoy a 1,000-year reign, really up until the 14th and the 15th century, as the preeminent tool of war. And a figure of the 15th century, one of the more enigmatic figures in all of history, and a man in love with war, was Charles, Duke of Burgundy, who ruled over a large expanse of French, Dutch, and German territory in the 1400s, and he dreamed of reviving a long-gone aspect of the Holy Roman Empire. But though a wealthy duchy, there was no coherence to Charles' dominions in terms of land or customs, well, aside from allegiance to him. Now, Charles was usually at war from his accession in 1467 to his death in battle with the Swiss in 1477. And in one crucial battle, the fog enveloped him. As noted in a piece by historian James Black Weiner, on March 2nd, 1476, at Concise in present-day northwestern Switzerland, the Swiss Confederates dealt the Burgundians a crushing defeat from which they would never recover. For the Swiss, Grandson signaled their emergence as an integral player in wider European affairs. It is popularly remembered as the battle in which the Swiss won the Burgundian booty, which enriched the soldiers who fought there. Weiner adds, Charles believed that the battle would be short and that the small Swiss force would be promptly defeated. What the Burgundians had not gathered from their reconnaissance was that the main body of the Swiss army was hidden in the forest, waiting to attack the Burgundian cavalry. The rapid arrival of the Swiss soldiers onto the field of battle caused a wave of panic on that part of the Burgundian army. Withdrawing from the field, the Swiss ultimately routed the Burgundian forces as Charles frantically ordered them to stop and return to the engagement. The short battle was over in roughly 3 hours, and each side lost about 300 to 400 men. But more significant concern to Charles was the loss of nearly 400 pieces of artillery, which proved decisive in subsequent sieges and battles in Switzerland. It was not just a surprise. The Swiss fought the battle on foot behind pikemen. Combined with the advent of the longbow and later infantry guns, this signaled the 1,000-year end of the primacy of mailed knights and cavalry. We know this now, but Charles did not. However, battles such as Agincourt in 1415 or Grandson did not spell the complete end of cavalry, which was still being used effectively into the 1800s, just that the horse became an addition, not the main piece. And foolishly, there were still horse brigades in 1914, and that ended horrifically. One of the patterns of war through history, and a significant failings of many generals, is the inability to keep things simple. During the earlier periods of the War for Independence, for example, George Washington often sketched out elaborate plans that an experienced, well-trained army would have had difficulty executing, much less the citizen armies which he commanded. As Atkinson notes, in the Battle for North Africa in 1942-43, the Allies landed troops at Casablanca under George S. Patton, along with Iran and Algiers. Still, after taking that city in 3 days, many of the troops were not immediately moved to Tunisia, where the Germans and Italians were making a last stand. The British 8th Army, victors over Erwin Rommel's Panzer Army Africa in October of 1942 at El Alamein, were not near enough to take that part of the continent from the south. Part of keeping Allied forces in Morocco was from fear that the Germans would come through Spain and take Gibraltar from the rear. This was a very unlikely event, and again, a complication to the overall plan of pushing the Axis out of North Africa. Part of it, too, was the simple inability to supply and rapidly move many troops. Either way, these distractions meant that the Germans were not defeated until May of 1943, when had the Allies planned adequately and kept things a little bit more simple, they might have won in late November of 1942. But I am also falling into that historian's trap again. Here I sit in my office in 2023, knowing things the Allies did not, knowing things the Allies could not understand when they hit the beaches of Casablanca, Iran, and Algiers on November 8, 1942. Because of the uncertainties with war, one must always wage or support them with the greatest amount of circumspection, something we learned the hard way in Iraq from 2003 through 2008. In that case, we waged war we should have probably in Vietnam, using light, mobile, elusive forces, never providing a clear target to the enemy. The fact, though, that we did that sort of mobile force, the light footprint, this actually only encouraged the Sunni forces in Iraq. What worked in the 2007 surge was what failed in Vietnam, applying an overwhelming, large, static force that partly impressed the Sunnis, who were also worrying about the rise of Shiite forces. Hence, they ceased their attacks on the Americans. So where does this leave us in the current war being waged in the Ukraine? Of moral clarity, there is much. This is not a territorial or regional dispute, as some have noted. It is naked, imperialistic aggression by Vladimir Putin's government, plain and simple. Hundreds of thousands have died. Millions have been displaced to the vanity of a single man. And sadly, there are antecedents throughout history of Putin's barbarism. Though there is moral clarity, the United States needs to view this war through the lens of self-interest. What is in our interest are two things: keeping Putin from any designs on NATO countries that adjoin Russia or her ally, Belarus. These include the Baltic nations, Poland, and now Finland. NATO must be inviolate, or the U.S. will cease to have influence abroad. The second is further deterrence to Russia, to China, and to Iran on their territorial, nakedly imperialistic designs. I support much of what the Biden administration is doing, but I would also furnish a small number of planes to the mix, but never American troops. That, I believe, in addition to all of the other equipment that has been sent and the financial assistance, a little bit of air cover. I think that would send the right message. But with the fog of war, we can never be certain of any outcome. But as a crucial component of conservatism itself, we have agency, and we can work to affect an outcome that will meet our interests. Thank you for listening to this latest Conservative Historian podcast. Please check all of them out. We've got over 150, and we cover all areas of history, all timelines, all places. Thanks.